This is Fresh Air. How does ethnic pride turn into ethnic cleansing? That's what Michael Ignatieff set off to find out. He traveled to six areas torn apart by ethnic nationalism, including the Balkans, Ukraine, Kurdistan, and Ireland. He reports on his findings in his new book, Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. It's a companion to his BBC series of the same name. Ignatieff says you may think that we're moving beyond nationalism toward a global culture. But in fact, the New World Order is the disintegration of nation-states into ethnic civil war. He had some frightening illustrations of this disintegration when he was stopped at checkpoints. He told me about one such experience at a UN checkpoint between a Croat and Serb-held section of central Croatia.
The Serb lines are divided from the Croatian lines by a UN checkpoint manned by some Canadian teenagers. But within about 10 yards from that checkpoint, our bus was boarded by some drunken Serbian paramilitaries who were at a wedding. They were brandishing bottles of plum brandy, and they wrenched the door of the van open when they realized that we were foreign journalists. And someone had seen us talking to some Croatians on the other side of the line, so they immediately concluded we were spies. They began yanking us out of the bus. One of them jumped into the bus and began to try and drive it off. And when we protested, he pulled out a Zastava pistol and pointed it at our heads. And the camera crew was saying, "Oh God, can't we shoot this?" And someone said, "Well, they'll probably shoot us if they do." And it spiraled very quickly into kind of ethnic paranoia and macho aggression, just short of murder. And there was about 30 seconds, a minute, when I thought, I'm not going to get out of here alive. And then a UN soldier came running up from the checkpoint, reached in through the window and grabbed the keys of the car, cocked his M16 and said, "I think we better sort this out my way," at which point a local Serbian policeman came running in, cocked his pistol and said, "No, we're going to sort it out my way," and we ended up spending 4 hours in a Serbian police station. And the moral of the story is that this is what the New World Order looks like face to face.
What is what it looks like?
Well, what it looks like is that the international community has put two teenage boys in between two feuding ethnic groups, given them very limited power to do anything, and within about 50 yards of these checkpoints mandated by diplomats in distant countries, it's a complete law of the jungle, and you can lose your lives crossing between one zone and the other.
You saw a lot of young men with guns at checkpoints and paramilitaries patrolling around, and you thought they had a semi-sexual relationship with their guns.
Well, a lot of kids have a semi-sexual relationship to their guns in, you know, South Central L.A. What's different in places like Yugoslavia is that this is a nationalist set of passions. That is, you got a lot of unemployed, semi-criminal, semi-delinquent kids who are recruited by local warlords to protect their people and are pumped up and pumped full of a nationalist rhetoric, which makes them defenders of their people. And when you do that, then everything is permitted. And so these kids swagger around at the checkpoints, flaunting their weapons at you, and they have behind them this kind of, I don't know, cultural mandate to behave as they do, which is to threaten you and taunt you and occasionally put a bullet in your head. And it's that junction between kind of nationalist rhetoric and erotic fantasy which produces a lot of really psychotic behavior in the South Balkans. I'm not saying the whole region is a kind of fanatical and erotically insane zone, but you can't make sense of the gratuitous violence and cruelty in that area. You know, 200,000 people have died, and often in very bestial and horrible circumstances. You can't make sense of that unless you see the ways in which the erotic energies of young men and the nationalist energies of politics are kind of fused together into one big green light for, you know, sadistic behavior.
One of the people you met with was Melo Vangelis?
Yes.
who was one of the key architects of post-war Yugoslavia and then broke with Tito in 1953. And he told you that he thought that the West had made a big mistake in satanizing, in demonizing the Serbs. What was his explanation for that?
Well, it's extremely interesting that Gilas, who is the first dissident in Eastern Europe, the very first one, I mean, you know, 25 years before Havel, 25 years before anybody else, for him to say that we demonize the Serbs is interesting because he's under almost semi-house arrest in Serbia for being so unpopular in Serbia. But his point was that the West wanted a simple story about ex-Yugoslavia. The West wanted good guys and bad guys and very quickly found the bad guy in Milosevic, when in fact the truth is that the collapse of Yugoslavia was a kind of fatal dynamic interaction between two nationalisms, or three nationalisms, in fact, Serbian nationalism, Croatian nationalism, Slovenian nationalism, and also Muslim nationalism. There's absolutely no doubt that Serbia bears the preponderant responsibility for the catastrophe. They were the aggressors in Croatia. The Bosnian Serbs were the aggressors in Bosnia. But you can't understand some of the Serbs' paranoia and murderous hatred unless you understand the extent to which they felt threatened by Croatian nationalism and Muslim nationalism. This is not to excuse the Serbs, to justify what they did, but a true understanding of what's happening there doesn't fixate on them alone as the source of the violence and doesn't fixate on them as the sole people responsible for ethnic cleansing. There's been ethnic cleansing on all sides. It doesn't make everybody equivalently guilty. It just makes the point that this is a very, very complex, tragic interaction between nationalisms which actually cannot be satisfied in the region. That's the key point. Nationalism is a fatal dream in the Balkans because there is, you know, because these ethnic groups are so interpenetrated, they live so much on top of each other, that for a nationalist to achieve his dream, which is to have all the Serbs in one state, requires him to engage in ethnic cleansing, requires him to drive out all the neighbors he lives on top of. Similarly, for a Croatian to dream of a Croatian nation requires him to drive out the ethnic Serbs in Croatia. And similarly, to the extent that there is a Muslim nationalism, it, unless it's prepared to accept multi-ethnicity and a kind of confessional difference in a society, it's required to push people out. That's what makes nationalism so truly suicidal in this region. You can only achieve the dream at the price of other people's blood.
My guest is Michael Ignatieff, author of the new book Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Ignatieff, author of Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. In one of your earlier books had to do with Russian history and your personal connection to Russian history through your grandparents and great-grandparents. In your new book, you write that being yourself is what ethnic nationalism will not allow. You've, I think, really looked to your past, looked to your heritage for a sense of your identity. And I'm wondering if you keep kind of shifting the line between what's healthy and what's unhealthy in terms of getting identity from the past, from your ethnic heritage, from your ancestors, from where they were from.
I think being an expatriate, that is being someone born in country in one country, making his life somewhere else, I have given a lot of thought to belonging and roots, and my past is plural. You know, it's Scottish, Canadian, and Russian, and all this and that. And that, I think, led to a quite anguished search for my roots and for my belonging that can be seen in previous books of mine, like The Russian Album. I think what has the nationalism book and Blood and Belonging taught me is just how dangerous it is to fully belong. There are claims of the past which can really unhinge people. There are mythologies of the past that kind of rise up from the grave and take possession of a people and can do them terrible harm. I mean, one of the moments in literature that always haunts me is that wonderful moment when when Juliet is up on the balcony and Romeo's hidden in the shadows. And Juliet is sort of thinking to herself, and she's a Montague, he's a Capulet, or the other way around, and she's trying to think about what is the nature of the claim of her family upon her. And she wants passionately to say, I am just Juliet. That's what I am first and last. I am not a prisoner of my family. I am not a prisoner of my past. I am not, by extension, a prisoner of these kind of ethnic gangs. And therefore, if I'm being told that I can't have anything to do with this man I love, the thing that is my enemy here is his name, and it's only a name. And I think that speaks very much to what is terrible about ethnic nationalism at its worst, is that it encloses people in a kind of total belonging, which simply swallows up the gulf that always exists between a personal identity and a national and social one. And it just, it deprives people of that kind of basic freedom to choose what they will belong to and choose in how far they will belong to something. And at its limits, when people are imprisoned by an identity, when it takes them over completely, it also takes over their conscience. And so they'll do anything in its name. And I felt I spent a year with a lot of people with guns who had simply surrendered themselves in some very deep human way. They simply could no longer listen to an individual voice of conscience that would say, it isn't such a great idea to shoot men, women, and children.
Do you think there are big differences between civic nationalism and ethnic nationalism?
Yes, a civic nationalism is rather the kind that you find in America. I mean, a civic nationalism says it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is, it doesn't matter where you come from, it doesn't matter what your blood is, what matters is whether you subscribe to the values and institutional rules of something called America. It's an allegiance to the state rather than allegiance to a particular ethnic nation. And now, it is true that most civic nations depend on a certain common tradition, set of experiences, but the great thing about the American case is that you have what all the international studies show is the most intensely patriotic and on occasion nationalistic society on earth. I mean, America is the home of the strongest form of nationalism there is, the most intense form of patriotic pride. But it's not accompanied by this kind of cruel and excluding emphasis on ethnicity. In fact, it's an incorporating kind of nationalism. It says everybody can belong to this dream. And what's astonishing is how powerful it is. Now, it may surprise Americans to hear themselves described as the most nationalistic society on earth. But in a sense, if you live outside America, that's what you feel. I don't say it in any hostile spirit because I feel tremendous attachment for a tradition that has, you know, Jefferson and Lincoln at the heart of it, as opposed to some call to ethnic blood and roots.
I think one of the big issues for the citizens of America and of England, where you live, is what is our responsibility to other countries that are torn apart now by ethnic fighting, places like Bosnia, like Rwanda, like Kurdistan. What is your impulse to feel that that we can intercede and help in other parts of the country? Is your impulse to first take care of what's wrong in your own part of the world?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that charity and moral commitment and moral obligation begins at home, and a society that doesn't look after its own is not a decent society. But I do think we have obligations overseas. I am a kind of cautious liberal internationalist. I think that we could have sent very clear, unequivocal signals to all the parties in the Bosnia and the Balkan conflict in 89 and 90 that might have stopped 200,000 people dying. It doesn't involve commitment of ground troops. It doesn't involve massive hemorrhaging commitments like Vietnam. It just means making very clear what our values and our commitments are so that bullies, so that dictators, so that demagogues know exactly where the six or seven most powerful nations in the world stand in relation to what they're trying to do. And we didn't do that after 89, and we could have. And we're now, and it's not us who are paying the price, it's the 200,000 people who've died in the Balkans who are paying the price. I'm a cautious liberal internationalist. We can't put the world to rights. We can't create law and order and a stable state in the Balkans. Only the people of the Balkans can do that. But we can tell them where we stand, and we can tell them that we won't allow violence and aggression and the forcible changing of frontiers by violence to go unpunished. And we haven't done that. We've let the demagogues, we've let the men of violence get away literally with murder. It's not, we can't live in a safe world if the international order means nothing. We can't live in a jungle. That's why, you know, this isn't a distant story. I haven't gone to the other side of the moon. I've gone to places that are within hours flying time from all the zones of safety in the world. And if we don't take our responsibilities seriously, those zones of danger will come creeping closer and closer and closer.
Michael Ignatieff, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
Michael Ignatieff is the author of Blood and Belonging, Journeys into the New Nationalism. It's the companion to his BBC series of the same name. This is Fresh Air.